Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church, on the web at ignatius.com.
We bring you this show that aired in the past and you may have missed it. Welcome to the best of Register Radio.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello discusses the United States Bishop's Campaign for Immigration Reform with Kevin Appleby, the Director of Migration Policy and Public Affairs for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And in the second half of the show, Dan Burke talks with President and CEO of Ave Maria Communications, Al Cresta, about his book, Dangers to the Faith, which outlines the sometimes subtle and at times downright brazen opposition to Catholicism that many Catholics face today. You may have faced this too, perhaps. Welcome to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Elena Rodriguez, sitting in for Tom Price this week, who is away on special assignment. We appreciate your prayers for his safe and productive travels. The executive director of the Register joins us in studio now. Hello, Dan Burke.
It's great to be with you, Elena.
I can say the same thing. I'm very happy to be here. You know, every week I'm the producer of Register Radio doing the behind-the-scenes work, but this week it's very good to be on this end of the mic. And Jeanette DeMello joins us right now to conduct our first interview. She is the editor-in-chief of the Register. Hello, Jeanette.
It's good to be here, too.
And a very warm welcome to you. Our first guest is Kevin Appleby. He joins us to talk about the United States Bishop's recent campaign for immigration reform. Kevin Appleby is the Director of Migration Policy and Public Affairs of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. He has testified before Congress on immigration issues and has represented the United States Catholic Bishops on these issues in the public square and also with the media. He is co-editor of the upcoming book, On Strangers No Longer, Perspectives on the U.S.-Mexican Catholic Bishop's Pastoral Letter on Migration. Kevin has a master's degree in international affairs from the George Washington University and a law degree from the University of Maryland. In the wake of the Senate's passage of immigration reform legislation this June and the House's plans to take up the issue this fall, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops decided to take their campaign for immigration reform to the pews. Kevin helped to spearhead that effort, and in the next few minutes, he'll talk about the bishop's message. Jeanette?
So, Kevin, the last time that I remember the bishops did a big campaign for immigration, I was working for Archbishop Chaput. That was in 2006, and I believe you and I worked a little bit together during that time.
We did, Jeanette. Yeah, it was 7 years ago. It was really the last time that the Congress debated an immigration reform bill of significance, 2007, actually. There was another bill, but it's taken that long to get back to the issue in Congress. We're still debating many of the same issues and have the same problems in the country in terms of our broken immigration system. So hopefully this time they'll get it right.
So the bill passed the Senate in June, this immigration reform bill. Now it's planning to be taken up by the House. Of course, the Syria crisis has kind of captured the attention of Congress and the administration. So it's been a little bit delayed, but we do hope that they take it up. Can you explain what the Senate bill does and maybe also what it doesn't do?
Well, what it does primarily is it brings 11 million undocumented persons out of the shadows, puts them on a path to citizenship. It's not an easy path. They have to do several things, pay a fine, pay fees, and learn English, keep working, and get in the back of the line. And they'll be able to get citizenship in 13 years, which is a long time. I would think anyone who travels that road really wants to be a U.S. citizen. Then we would have some changes to the legal immigration system, some improvements in the family area to allow families to be reunited more quickly, and creation of a low-skilled program to allow migrant workers to come in legally instead of having to come across the border to find work. In many industries, we need these workers, and if we let them come legally, we know where they're working, we know where they're going, and it also provides safety for them. So these are provisions that the bishops support. There's also some provisions on protecting asylum seekers, which we support. There's also a lot of enforcement in the bill. There's a border amendment, which we think goes a bit too far, and there are other enforcement mechanisms. So it's a balanced bill overall. It's not perfect, but it really contains many of the elements that the bishops are looking for.
Now, it's probably that balance that you talk about, the balance of security and then also a pathway to citizenship that actually helped this bill to get passed in the Senate. But it faces opposition in the House. What's going on in the House?
Well, the House has a different political dynamic. You have members who are in districts and don't feel pressure politically to move on this issue as senators might in larger states. So we still are optimistic. I think the House might take a different road to get to the end product. They might pass separate bills on different topics within immigration, not one big bill like the Senate did. But at the end of that process, they would bundle them all together, and ideally they would work out differences with the Senate on their view on the policy issues. And then in an ideal situation, we'd get a bill from both chambers by the end of the year. With the Syria crisis that you mentioned and the budget debate upcoming, it may push it into next year for a final bill.
This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking with Kevin Appleby, who is representing the U.S. Bishops Conference on Immigration Reform. Now, Kevin, I think it's this hopefulness that this bill can actually get passed Congress that has the bishops in this position of really speaking out and taking their campaign for immigration reform to the pews. So you mentioned the last time this happened was 2006, and it was a pretty big campaign. September 8th was a key date last Sunday. Parishes were supposed to rally around this issue. Can you tell us a little bit about what has happened?
Well, yes, the debate's at a critical moment. What we learned from the 2006-2007 debates is that in order to get a bill like this passed, you really need to generate grassroots support in local areas. As you all know, politics is local. So what the bishops are doing is trying to raise awareness within the Catholic community about the issue, encourage Catholics to contact their legislators and ask them to support immigration reform. Now, the bishops enter this debate with eyes wide open. They understand there's not unanimity within the Catholic community on this issue. There are those in the Catholic community that respectfully disagree on some of the bishops' suggestions. What we all agree on is that this system needs to be reformed, and It's important that Catholics be part of the debate. And what the bishops are trying to do is inform Catholics as to what the church's position is and why it's important to create a system that protects basic human rights of our brothers and sisters.
It seems like one of the biggest messages of the bishops is we can't do nothing, like that this is so urgent a problem that it needs to be reformed, and how we go about doing that, perhaps there are different ways, different prudential judgments on how that happens. But the bishops do have basically six elements of reform that they are requesting. Can you go over those elements?
Sure. As I mentioned, the bringing people out of the shadows, the path to citizenship is important, and letting people to get into the system, become American citizens is up front. We also believe there should be a program that allows future migrants who want to come and work and who we deem we need, that they can come legally and safely, which we really don't have that system now. Thirdly, we'd like to see families protected. Of course, family unity is the core to any society, and we want to preserve family unity as the cornerstone of the immigration system. Fourth, we want to restore some due process protections to immigrants. Everyone needs their day in court. Judges need to have more discretion in cases where there are mitigating circumstances, and right now their hands are really tied. We're also very concerned about the detention system that's exploding for immigrants and the for-profit detention industry, and whether immigrants are not a threat and are going to report to their court cases need to be detained. We also believe that asylum seekers and refugees who have a special claim to protection, take, for example, the Syrian refugees who are fleeing, fighting in their country, that they are protected. And lastly, and this is an interesting point, is we think there should be some sort of debate on root causes, why people are coming in the first place, what's compelling them. They're certainly coming for economic reasons, they're coming for persecution reasons. Let's look at the global economy. What are we doing that may inadvertently compel people to come? What can we do to encourage them to stay where they are so they can support their families and dignity, that jobs are created there? A lot of misunderstanding about that issue. It's not that we're going to send our jobs over there. It's just like, are we entering into trade agreements which inadvertently or sending people to this country because their jobs are being eliminated. Let's examine those issues and see if we can at least do no harm.
It seems as though when people object to immigration and why don't they stay where they are, there's a misunderstanding that a lot of times people will come to the country because they really are seeking the basic sustenance of life, work and a way to live. Their homeland is not providing that. But there are things that the U.S. does that makes it even more difficult for them in their own countries. Can you explain more in depth what are some of those problems?
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert in the field. I think Catholic Relief Services, our partner, has more in-field experience of what's going on. But,
okay.
I mean, for example, we entered into the North American Free Trade Agreement in the early 90s. Has that had an impact on farmers and farm workers in Mexico? Their jobs have been eliminated because we may, for example, be providing more agricultural products to Mexico under the agreement. Is this compelling them to come to the United States to find jobs?
Sure.
I don't know the answer. There's been a mixed review on that, but at least it needs to be examined. Same thing with the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Has that done the same thing? Other international economic agreements, what is the impact on low-skilled workers in poorer countries than the United States? In all these agreements, we need to look at what the labor impact is. The one thing, Jeanette, we have to remember is that in our world now, we can trade communications, we can trade goods, we can trade capital at a moment's notice across boundaries, but we really have a hard time with labor. And if you consider that the world's a marketplace and that the jobs are in some part of the marketplace and the labor's in another part of the marketplace, you got to adjust for that reality. And many countries, not only the United States, have had a hard time understanding that in the future we may, in fact, and now we need workers who are low-skilled in certain industries to pick our food, to clean our hotel rooms, et cetera. So really what the United States would do if we pass this bill is have new ground, maybe a global model for allowing laborers to come in legally and work in the United States and safely.
Yeah. It's great to hear how in-depth the USCCB is thinking about these things and really seeking to find solutions on many different fronts of this complex issue. One of the biggest concerns I hear people make, and that is, what about the rule of law? I mean, if these people are here illegally, they did something illegal to be where they are, and we're just going to allow them a path to citizenship, you know, doesn't this work against the rule of law? What is your response to that?
It's a very good question. It's a very legitimate question. In the context of the whole system, you know, what this path of citizenship would do is it would make people pay a fine. It would make them do other things to get the citizenship. So it's not like we're granting them something, what many people would call an amnesty, without something in return, without paying their debt to society. It's not like they're going to get away scot-free. The rule of law is maintained to some degree. Now, others may disagree that it's not a harsh enough penalty, for example, so that's where really the debate is. But you also have to consider the broader context of our responsibility as a nation. We do accept the labor of undocumented immigrants. We do accept their taxes. They do pay income taxes. They pay sales taxes. They work in important industries, in agriculture, for example, but we don't offer them the protection of the law. You know, as a nation built on democracy, can we do that? I mean, do we really want a permanent underclass where we're accepting their, you know, what they're giving, but we're not giving anything back? And I think that's the broader question for the country. Do we want a society like that? The other thing in terms of the penalties, you know, when a judge makes a judgment on a sentence of an offense, he looks at the intent of the act and the effect of the act. The intent of someone who first-degree murder charge is someone wanted to kill someone, and they did. So they should get the maximum penalty because of the harm created. If you look at a migrant, by and large, their intent is just to survive. And we believe the effect is that overall they're helping our country by working. So the penalty should be commensurate to the offense. I think where folks have a hard time is that 11 million people have done it. If it was,
right.
And if there's one person that they know that did it, they're like, oh, wow, why are we deporting this person when they're doing all these great things and otherwise they're law-abiding but they're out of status? I've heard many stories on an individual level. I think what scares people is that we'd be doing this for 11 million people, and what's the long-term impact of that, and what does it mean for people coming in the future?
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being here. People can find out more information about the USCCB's campaign at justiceforimmigrants.org. That's justiceforimmigrants.org. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
And my thanks to you as well, Kevin. When we return, do you feel the whole world is cornering you because of your faith and you're the only odd duckling out there? Well, you're not alone, and we'll empower you to do something about it. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us. John at Bankovic talks about the National Catholic Register.
I recommend the National Catholic Register to all Catholics who want to discover what it means to live their faith in this our day and time. We get the clear, unbiased news of today because the National Catholic Register takes its cue from the mind and the heart of the Church. It really becomes a tool by which we are able to live that abundant life in Jesus Christ and to share that life with others. The National Catholic Register seeks to meet people where they are, seeks to meet people where they are in their walk of faith, where they are practically in their lives at the moment.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner, or call 800-854-6316.
We're bringing you this show that aired in the past, and you may have missed it. Welcome back to the best of Register Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. Along with Janetta Mello and Dan Burke, I'm Elena Rodriguez, producer of Register Radio. I'm sitting in for Tom Price this week, who is away on special assignment. Please pray for his safe and productive travels. He will be back with us next week. The Register's executive director, Dan Burke, will conduct our next interview. Welcome back, Dan.
Oh, it's great to be here.
If you tune in to EWTN Radio, you will be very familiar with our next guest, Al Cresta. He joins us to talk about the sometimes subtle and at times downright brazen opposition to Catholicism that Catholics face today. You may have faced this too, perhaps. Al Cresta is the author of the forthcoming book, Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. Al is also a broadcaster, a journalist, and president and CEO of Ave Maria Communications, host of Ave Maria's radio talk show, Cresta in the Afternoon, which airs on EWTN Radio, and he is also the national spokesman for StopHHS.com, the largest grassroots effort to fight against the HHS mandate. And Al, I'm dying to know, are you holding the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other? Welcome to Register Radio.
No, I've got the phone in my left hand.
Wait a minute. I thought it was the National Catholic Register in one hand.
But see, I don't have to critique the National Catholic Register.
Right.
Oh.
It stands on its own. We're on the same team.
We are. You actually just wrote a great piece for us recently. We're grateful to have you contributing.
Well, Dan, it's good to be talking with you.
So, Al, tell me, what compelled you to write this book? I mean, obviously, you're a man that follows the what's happening every day of the year in the church and outside.
Well, my concerns in this book are longstanding concerns, but why now is the question. And I think it's because we've turned a corner in Western culture in the United States. One quick example is in this recent conflict over same-sex so-called marriage. Many people may not realize that every single social reform movement that was based on morality or ethics, every change in America's social morality in the past has always appealed to Christianity. It's always tried to get the churches to legitimate the move, whether it's prohibition, whether it's the anti-slavery cause, and even the more recent civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. That movement was born in the black church. It was taken and championed by mainline Protestant denominations. It was led by pastors and praying laity. However, this so-called civil rights movement for same-sex so-called marriage was born in a homosexual bar, a gay bar, a riot that took place there back in 1969. And it has been foisted upon us by an awesome media power. And I'm assuming that the gay marriage thing is going to settle into this culture. with that, we will see the turning of a corner in American Catholicism and in American Christianity. It will have been the first civil rights movement, the first social reform movement in America that did not have to appeal to Christianity to find its legitimation, to appeal to purely secular principles.
And all we're going to have to do, Al, I think, is look, as you know, to what's going on in Canada to understand what's going to happen to us. Of course, it's already happening with the persecution of the flower shop folks around several different cases around gay marriage and Christians objecting on grounds of conscience. But things are not looking good.
No, and I think, you know, we need to fight, need to bear witness, but we have to bear witness differently than I think we did in the past. And that's what led to the writing of this book. We should regard ourselves now as a very distinct minority. According to Matthew Kelly, Catholics who are well catechized, committed to the faith, who are doing the work of building up the body of Christ, are roughly 7%. And that makes us a very distinct minority. And minorities have to work for change. They have to represent themselves differently. That's just a fact of life. When you're no longer the dominant culture, you have to make your case in a different way. If you're a minority, you are tempted to certain sins that majority cultures aren't tempted to. So, for instance, minorities are often given to resentment and bitterness, a sense of being alienated from the surrounding culture. Their leaders are mocked more frequently. In our case, people misstate our doctrines and then ridicule them, ridicule their own misstatements of them. So we'll have to be prepared to endure that. And I think Jesus' statement about loving our enemies is coming to the fore in a way that it didn't in the past. We really do have opponents. We really do have enemies. It's not just the weight of culture shifting into a different direction. There really are groups that are committed to discrediting the moral authority of the Catholic Church. And, of course, the Church itself, I mean, Catholics themselves have done their own work at discrediting us. But my book is focusing on external opponents, and they really are there. And I think we have to figure out how to love them without in any way accommodating ourselves to the worldly schemes and the culture.
This is Dan Burke with Register Radio. We're talking with Al Cresta about his new book, Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. Al, you outline in the book all of these key threats. Was there any order or priority to them? The New Age and spiritual corruption, which you and I have talked about on the air before. Mm-hmm. But was there a prioritization to that?
Yeah, I begin with what I call the new self-styled spirituality of Oprah. Now, she claims she's not New Age, so I took her at her word. However, there's no doubt that she has adopted a view of Jesus, which comes right out of the 19th century. Well, we didn't use this phrase in the 19th century, but in the 19th century is the mind science movement, which is really today's New Age movement. Her view of Jesus is directly related to the 19th century New Thought movement, mind science movements. And then there's another chapter which deals directly with the more Shirley MacLaine-style New Age teaching. But I started with the Oprah case because roughly one-third of the people surveyed said that Oprah's had a greater spiritual impact on their lives than their own pastors. And I think she represents kind of the mainstream American spirituality today. After 9/11, when the nation was healing and trying to make sense of what had happened, Mayor Rudy Giuliani had a memorial service at Yankee Stadium. And he invited all kinds of pastors and imams and priests and bishops to participate and to pray. But for MC, he chose Oprah Winfrey. She was the one he thought who could best kind of ecumenically hold them all together. She was seen as the center of American spirituality. A generation ago, Giuliani, or the mayor of New York at that time, would have asked the Archbishop of New York, perhaps, would have asked maybe Billy Graham to be the MC figure for an event like this, but not this time. It was a woman who's a social entrepreneur and a very effective entertainer. She was the one who headed up this moment of national healing. So that's why I began with Oprah. I think her new self-styled spirituality, the idea that we can pick and choose from all these different traditions, we can take a little bit of Tai Chi and mix it with New Testament, and while we're at it, give me some crystal power, and I'll also take, oh, I like the Psalms too. Can we weave those in there? That's the kind of spirituality that she represents.
It really harkens back, though, to the Old Testament. I remember the psalm that talks about their gods, making their own gods who can't speak or can't hear. I mean, it's all about self-worship in the end, and then projecting what we desire onto God so that we're judged appropriately, even when we're maybe in radical denial of what God actually desires of us.
Dan, that's well said. In fact, after I get done with the Oprah chapter, I go to that very thing with the New Age movement, which is really the attempt to divinize ourselves. And the emphasis in the more mature New Age thinkers, their emphasis is self-discovery. And by that, they mean the discovery of our own divinity.
Yeah.
And in discovering our own divinity, we break down the creator-creature distinction, which is central to Christianity, and we begin to define reality according to our own experience. Because, look, if I've discovered my own divinity, then what does divinity do? Divinity defines reality.
Exactly.
So we move from the new self-styled spirituality of Oprah, which is a bit seductive and appears to be somewhat liberating. We move from that to New Age, the more hardcore New Age spirituality, which I think is clearly demonic and satanic, and goes right back to the promise of Genesis 3, where Eve was tempted to violate God's norms in the garden and to eat the fruit of the tree in order that she might become like God.
And that's a great point to stop there on, Al. I wish we had more time. I think your book is really something that every Catholic should pick up. It's Dangers to the Faith, Recognizing Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. If you pick Al's book up and read that, you're going to find yourself equipped to handle a very broad array of these challenges, and in a way that'll give you the ability to battle them, even if it's in your own head or in your own parish or in your own community. Al, thank you so much for this important work.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
And my thanks to you as well, Al. And don't forget, you can listen to the show again by going to ncregister.com and look for the microphone icon to listen or download the show. On behalf of Dan Burke, Jeanette DeMello, Tom Price, Richard Jesse, Kevin Appleby, Al Cresta, and all of us here at the Register and at EWTN Radio, this is Elena Rodriguez thanking you for joining us on Register Radio. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Register Radio is sponsored by Ignatius Press, the premier publisher of outstanding Catholic books, magazines, videos, and music, faithful to the magisterium of the Church, on the web at ignatius.com.